with me. Thanks for joining Banfield. But boy, have I got a surprise for you. I have just had such an incredible conversation with Amanda Knox. She's just dropped this memoir, and there are some things in here that you should hear. But there are some things that she told me that are not in the book. Things that happened to her while she was in that Italian prison that we did not know until now, almost two decades later. Not only that, some advice, believe it or not, for the survivors of the Idaho quadruple murder. Don't forget, Amanda Knox has been a punching bag for two decades. Even though she's been completely cleared of murder, there are still haters out there who cannot stop taking the boots to her online. And we all know there are haters out there who are doing the same thing to two of those survivors from the Idaho murder house. Amanda Knox has some advice for those two survivors, and it is so fascinating because she's been through it and she knows the path. So we're going to talk about that tonight. Also, how she's reconnected with the prosecutor in her case. It is an incredible relationship that they have developed. All that's coming ahead. And then also, it is normal to snap selfies when you're on vacation in beautiful locations. It's also normal to snap selfies with the one you love. It is not normal to throw that one you love off a cliff. That's the allegation tonight, that this beautiful couple, apparently not exactly as they appear in photos. The allegation is that in Hawaii, this pair, professional, well-to-do, living in Hawaii and vacationing on another island, took a hike, and ultimately she ended up at the bottom of a cliff with her head bashed in with a rock. She survived, and he went on the run. But he's been arrested. I'm going to tell you the entire story. Peel back all the layers of those very beautiful photos that they show on Facebook. And then there's this. Cops really never know what they're going to get when they answer a 911 call, right? It could be anything. It could be a bird up a tree, cat up a tree, or it could be a man with a chainsaw at a retirement home, which is what happened. And the video shows what the police encountered when they got to the retirement home. A man who apparently had a beef or thought he had a beef and wanted to see his wife. Take a look at this.
Hey, drop the chainsaw. Drop the chainsaw. What a taser point.
Oh my God.
Hey, drop it.
Yeah. Here's a hint. He didn't. He kept on starting it and then went for a run through all of the residents, some of them in wheelchairs, unable to move. You're going to see on the body cam two different perspectives how they brought that to an end. And it is harrowing, to say the least. Let me start here, though. It's been almost 20 years since a young American student studying abroad was thrown into an Italian jail cell and accused of murdering her roommate. Almost immediately, Amanda Knox became a household name as the internet began to dissect her every look, her every move, arguably looking for all the things that made her look guilty. And it worked. Because between the internet and the flawed Italian prosecution, Amanda was convicted of that murder and she was jailed. And it would be another 4 years behind bars before they realized their mistake and righted that wrong. Amanda, let's be clear, was fully cleared of that murder, even though authorities tried to stick her with some minor technicalities afterwards. And although that should have been the beginning of an effort to reclaim her good name and her life, it was instead the beginning of a whole other journey that she had no idea lay ahead. Battling the stigma, the haters, the naysayers, and the obstinate trolls who refuse to accept the truth that she's not guilty. Amanda took pen to paper, and she's written all about the roadblocks that she never expected in her new memoir, Free, My Search for Meaning. Sprinkled throughout the book, anecdotes of what happened to her in that Italian prison, and let's just say it ain't like America over there. Amanda Knox is an exoneree. She's a journalist, an advocate for media ethics and criminal justice. And she also co-hosts the podcast called Labyrinths. I spoke with Amanda just a few hours ago. This is your second memoir.
Yeah.
And this really focuses on some things I didn't think were going to happen.
Okay. Okay, yeah.
Being in the world
Neither
of crime.
Neither did I.
Right? I can imagine. In my line of work, those who have been through the criminal justice system and have been treated unfairly don't really want to go back to that pool and dabble and find out why. But you did. You went back to the prosecutor who put you away, asking questions.
Yeah.
Tell me, A, why, and B, what'd you ask?
Great question. And you're right. Everyone that I talked to in the lead up to doing this and making this decision, in the innocence community, my friends who are lawyers, my friends who are exonerees, my own family, everyone thought I was crazy. Everyone thought that I had a weird fixation on this, I had Stockholm syndrome maybe. Like, I was clearly interested in this human being who had hurt me. And there was some understanding on the part of the exonerees that I talked to, because they want to understand why this had happened to them. But they all told me, it's a losing game. Your prosecutor is never going to see you as a person. He's never going to admit that he's wrong, and you're just wasting your time. And I was afraid of that. Like, a part of me first reached out to him because I wanted to get in touch with him outside of an adversarial system where, you know, as you know, like, the courtroom can be a lot like politics, where there are two sides and ne'er shall the two meet on any issue. Mm-hmm. And I felt like that sort of conflict made it impossible for him to see me as a human being. And as someone who was living with the consequences of being the girl accused of murder, the stigma of that, trying to make sense of that in my own life, the first question I was asking myself was, why? Why is this my life? And I couldn't think of anyone better to ask that than the man who made this my life.
Your life.
And so I originally reached out to him, and I'll be honest, like, I reached out to him hoping that if I could show him who I really was, he would recognize that I was not the person that he thought he was prosecuting, that he was wrong. And then the pandemic happened, and this meeting that I thought we were going to have in the, like, immediately after I asked him didn't take place because there was, the world was imploding. And so we spent 2 years corresponding before we ever met in person. And those 2 years were filled with frustrating conversations about the case, but they were also filled with, like, just personal revelations. We are a shared love of animals, a shared love of classical music, a shared love of Lord of the Rings. He was stunned. Like, and very quickly had a shift in perspective about who I was because I had reached out to him. It was just unheard of. And he was even unsure of whether it was even legal for him to communicate
really
with me. Yes, because it had never been done before. And so he looked into case law to see if it was even allowed for him.
Because he's putting things in writing.
Yeah, yes, you know? Exactly. And he was thinking, I don't know if this is even allowed, but there's no law because no one has ever tried it. And so he agreed to correspond with me after I made a very public statement, sort of claiming that he wasn't an evil monster. Mm-hmm. And he felt sort of honor bound to respond to me. And he was deeply moved by the fact that I genuinely wanted to know him as a human being, because he never really had been interested to know me as a human being.
Like, but did something change? Did you get the apology? Did you get any kind of satisfaction from how your repartee went?
So there's this little metaphor that I'm using to describe what it was that I attained from this conversation, this prolonged conversation, and then this meeting, because this meeting took place in person after the 2 years that we corresponded.
In Perugia.
In Perugia. I went back to Italy, I went back to Perugia, and I sat down face to face. I had not seen and been in a room with this man since the courtroom. So here was this man that I had not encountered outside of this, like, legal environment, sitting across from me, wearing a fishing vest, looking like anybody's grandpa. And we sat across from each other. He held my hand, and he listened to what I had to say first. I told him that I was innocent, that he was wrong about me, and, you know, proceeded to, like, make the case, not letting him off the hook for, like, how he had harmed me. But then, you know, showing up and letting him know that I did not think he was a monster. And in fact, I cared about him, and I wished him well. Because I had, over the course of 2 years, gotten to know him as the complex, flawed, but ultimately precious human being that he was.
Did that disarm him enough to reciprocate.
Yes.
And say, I'm sorry.
So he did not say, I'm sorry. He did not say, I was wrong. He did say, you are not the person that I thought I was prosecuting. And that if I were asked to prosecute this case again today, I would not.
Wow. You write about some of the experiences with the prison guards.
Yeah.
And the reason why you cut your hair off short and why you wore baggy, dingy clothing.
Yes.
It's very upsetting to see.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but explain some of the things that happened from those guards and how far it went.
Yeah. So I was the famous one in the prison. I was one of the youngest prisoners. I was also one of the few prisoners that had all of my teeth. I was a cute little kid, and I was also being highly sexualized in the media as this, like, whore who would go with anybody. And so I think some male guards got the idea that if they could just find themselves alone in a room with me, they could take advantage of that. And so two things come to mind. One is that the vice comandante, the second in command in the prison, for something like 2 weeks was bringing me into a private office alone in the first weeks of my being in prison, and was asking me about my sex life. And it was just like, he wanted to know what kind of underwear I liked to wear, what kind of positions I liked to be in, if I would like to have sex with him. And I constantly, like, in that moment, I froze. I didn't really know what to do. I pretended that I didn't understand him. He would get frustrated or bored and then send me back, but he would kept bringing me back in. Another occasion was I was in my cell, and the plumbing stopped working in our cell, so they had to bring in some plumbers, and the guard was supervising the plumbers in the cell, and then they left, but I was in the bathroom sort of showing them that, you know, it wasn't going down the drain, and as soon as the plumbers left, he grabbed me around the waist, pulled me into him, and, like, swooped in to try to kiss me. And I don't even remember, like, how I had, it didn't feel like I had the presence of mind. I felt like I was in slow motion and kind of underwater, and I just, like, swooped underneath him, like, dodging his face, and, like, pirouetted out of his arms, and then went back onto my bed and like waited for a female guard to come by, and I just sat there.
Terrified.
I didn't move. I just sat there and just stared at the bed until he left. Because then what was I going to do?
Did it ever go beyond that?
No, I mean, I was, you know, stripped naked and photographed, but that was part of my, you
process.
Know, yeah, that was part of the process. And I was routinely stripped naked in order to visit, like, anytime I wanted to visit my family members. So, like, this whole process of prison, I don't know if you know, is, like, utterly degrading.
Yes, it
it's
is.
Very dehumanizing.
Yep. You lose everything.
You lose everything.
Your rights, everything.
Absolutely. And so, like, I had to, once I was immersed in that environment, I had to, well, at first, I felt like I was living somebody else's life by mistake. And so my family and I had this, like, metaphor of there's a light at the end of the tunnel, and we just have to, like, hold on and get through until we get to the end of the tunnel. But then when the verdict came in and I was facing a 26-year sentence, I no longer felt like there was any light, and that the truth mattered, and that I would ever be vindicated. And so I reframed my experience to be like, okay, how do I make this worth living?
When there's a media circus, and I mean, you name it, Jodi Arias, Casey Anthony, whether it was the Foxy Noxy headline,
mm-hmm.
Now we have Idaho. And I saw something developing in Idaho I just could not believe.
What's
and that
on?
Was the quadruple murder of these four students in Idaho two surviving roommates. Suddenly the internet decided to attack the two surviving roommates, to suggest that they had something to do with it. And I wondered what your thoughts are about that kind of a dynamic that's now playing out.
Right, that if somebody's, like, there's a sort of survivor's guilt by proxy, where if you have survived a crime, that must mean that you must be involved with it, because how otherwise might have you survived it? You know, that I find that deeply, deeply troubling, that, like, not only have they been utterly victimized by this experience, but now they are being suspected merely because they are they are victims of the crime, physically present. Like, that's insane. And it's very similar to my case where, like, I lived in that house. That's what the prosecution could prove. But they immediately latched onto this idea that it was a conspiracy, that it wasn't the break-in that it seemed, and therefore the roommate has to be involved.
Do you have advice for these two young women who are in this world, that they're trolled endlessly? They have to go through a trial, they have to testify, and they're traumatized by the hell they've been through.
Mm. Well, first of all, are they actually being accused by the detectives?
Just the internet trolls.
Just the internet trolls. Yeah. Okay, so as long as they...
Different.
Right, they don't need to lawyer up necessarily. Right. What I would say is, and this is going to be hard for them, but do not take it personally, because whatever people are projecting onto you, they're projecting onto an idea of you that doesn't exist, that says way more about them than it does about you. Protect yourself. And you know what? Like, you don't have to engage with the online. It really doesn't matter. It isn't a part of who you are. It is in the sense that, like, our reputation matters because it allows us, it's like a bank account. It's how we can navigate the world. Who I am is, and in the eyes of another human being, will impact the way that I can relate to that human being. However, the trolls, you know, I have yet to encounter an actual troll in my human life. I only encounter them online. And
the bravery.
I know, right?
The bravery of it.
Right? And I mean, you know, but there are people out there who will threaten your life, who, and so you don't know, so you have to live in a constant state of paranoia. Obviously, like, keep track of that. Get yourself a victim support person. Go to the FBI and have them track it. Like, all of that. I had to go to the FBI and do that when somebody was sending me very, very explicit death threats, and they went and knocked on his door and were like, hey, I guess you have freedom of speech, but you might want to knock it off because we're paying attention to you. Like, be safe, but do not take it personally.
My thanks to Amanda Knox, and you're going to hear a lot more of my interview with her tomorrow night on this program, including a very surprising revelation about that prosecutor who put her away and something that he now does every single day. Plus, what happened to Amanda when she returned to the crime scene in Italy years after her trial, and how Harry Potter helped her to survive prison. All of that tomorrow night. Make sure you join us. And still to come tonight, the prison thing in America that people don't talk about much. What goes on behind closed doors during conjugal visits? Turns out at one California prison, it is not just quality time. At least two women have met violent deaths during conjugal visits in just the last year. Tonight, what happened to Tanya Thomas? And how could a second woman have met the very same death at the very same prison just a few months later? Tanya's cousin is live with me next.
Thanks for listening to News Nation on the Go. I'm Chris Cuomo. This is America's fastest growing cable news network, delivering fact-based, unbiased news from all sides.
Perk that every inmate wants to get. Conjugal visits. Alone time. Behind prison walls with a spouse, with a lover, and sometimes even with family and kids. Not much is known about what happens behind those special apartment doors because this is private time. And it is meant to be incentive for prisoners to behave. But at least two California prisoners are under suspicion of killing their visitors while in the midst of conjugal visits last year. If you were with us last night on this program, you heard the story of Stephanie Stevie Dowles. Stevie was visiting David Brinson, a man that she had actually married behind prison walls. Last November, Stevie was strangled while on that conjugal visit. Months later, David Brinson has yet to be charged, and her family is only now getting information about how she died. And if that is surprising, maybe it shouldn't be. Because just 4 months before Stevie was killed, Tanya Thomas died in nearly the same way on a conjugal visit in that very same prison. Last summer, Tanya drove 3 hours to the Mule Creek State Prison for a conjugal visit with convicted felon Sean Curry. Curry's a violent carjacker and attempted murderer. And though Tanya shared a child with him, her family and her friends had no idea that they had secretly married. Curry was serving 34 years to life for shooting a 19-year-old woman in the head and then dumping her at a truck stop. She was permanently blinded and partially paralyzed from that attack. But despite all that, Tanya still took him back. Tanya's conjugal visit with Sean was scheduled for July 1st at Mule Creek. At that prison, the visits can last up to 40 hours for inmates. But by 6 a.m. the next morning, Tanya Thomas was dead. Curry told the prison officials that Tanya just didn't wake up. But months later, the coroner said something else, that Tanya had actually been strangled. And it took until last week, a full 9 months later, for Sean Curry to be charged with murder. And again, even though Tanya died in July, 4 months later, Stevie Dowles was killed during her conjugal visit to an inmate who was serving four life sentences at Mule Creek. I'm joined now exclusively by Janine Rojo. She is Tanya Thomas's cousin. Janine, thank you so much for agreeing to talk with me on the program tonight. And I'm very sorry that you and your family are going through this loss, especially with this compounding story that this happened twice. When and how did you learn that Tanya had died?
Well, first of all, thank you for giving us this spotlight to air our story. It's very tragic. So she died on July 1st of 2024. However, her son did not get the phone call that she died until the very next day, July 2nd. So we did not know until the next day that she passed away.
And she was, as I understand it, Janine, more like a sister to you. Did she ever mention much about Sean Curry? I mean, that she'd even been talking with him, let alone secretly married him?
She definitely did not let us know that they got married and that they were intimately involved the past few years. However, because they do share a son together, he has been in contact with her since he's been in jail for the past 25 years. So we were used to them talking here and there on the phone, but we did not know that they ended up getting married and were planning on if he was supposed to get out on parole in January 2024, we had no idea that they were planning on living a life together.
So what did you know about him? And did you and the family think much about Sean Curry?
So we've known him since high school. That's where we met. This was, I can't remember, but we were about 15, 16 years old. And we all had the same circle of friends. He was actually a really cool guy. I mean, he didn't show any red flags. He was kind of laid back demeanor, just like Tanya. And then they got intimately involved and she ended up getting pregnant. But then during her pregnancy, he kind of just disappeared. And then while she was in labor in 1999, that's when I saw that he was on the news. And he was on the news because he shot his 19-year-old girlfriend, Zaneta Brown, I believe that's her name. He shot her in the head and dumped her body at a construction site and left her for dead. She survived because of good Samaritans that found her the very next day. But Tanya was in labor when all of this happened. And then after that, he was on the news again because they didn't find him. He was on the run and they were looking for him. That's why he was on the news. He was doing carjackings and robberies. I mean, he was just going crazy for about a week or two before they finally found him. And he's been in jail since 1999.
So they share a 25-year-old child together now.
Yeah.
Did share. Is there some thought that Sean lied to her about having a parole hearing and maybe was dangling hope that he was going to get out and that she may have actually set him straight on this conjugal visit, meaning I know that you don't have a parole hearing till 2027, and that maybe that sparked a conflict behind those apartment doors?
So he was being truthful about the parole hearing that he had in January 2024. However, it got denied. And I heard from her best friend after she already passed away, because her best friend was the only person that she told anything to. The family was left out in the dark. Tanya didn't tell us anything because she knew we would not approve, and we were concerned for her safety as far as being in a relationship with him and him being out of jail. So the parole hearing, he got denied in January 2024, and it's my understanding that he told her to wait for him because he was up for another parole hearing in January 2025. However, Tan learned that he really was not up for parole, because if you look it up in the system, it's public information, that he had the date of 2027 for the next parole hearing. So we're not sure. We're kind of speculating at this point. We're thinking maybe she went there in July to kind of bid her farewells with him and let him know, hey, I'm not going to wait another 2-3 years for you. I've already a good 25 years. And if you're not going to get out, then I need to just move on with my life. This is what we're thinking. We may not ever find out what the reason was, but that's kind of what's...
But, you know, one thing you did find out, Janine, was that 4 months later, Stevie Dowles died during a conjugal visit with a dangerous offender. What was your reaction when you heard this, just 4 months after you lost your cousin?
So when I first, I found out, I heard about it on the news in November of 2024, and... But they didn't give a name and they did not give a cause because it's still under investigation. And I automatically knew. I said, whoever went there to visit, he killed her. And I know that's what happened. So it was a matter of time. And I was praying that I would eventually learn her name and, excuse me, her family, because I want to contact them. They need to know that this same exact thing just happened in July to my cousin. And it shouldn't happen to Tanya, but it definitely should not have happened to Stevie. I mean,
I agree with you there. I mean, it's just stunning to hear two women killed in 1 year at the same institution, both on conjugal visits. Janine Rojo, thank you so much for doing this. And again, my heart goes out to you and your family and your loss. Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate this.
And I do want to tell our viewers, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, we reached out to them and they gave us a statement about family visits. And let me read it for you. It says, CDCR family visits are a privilege. And incarcerated persons must apply and meet strict eligibility criteria to be approved. These visits are designed to support positive family connections and successful rehabilitation. CDCR follows established procedures regarding family visit security measures, including conducting regular counts during the visits, as well as inspections and searches when the need arises. But we did not get specific information about these two cases. Coming up after the break, there is kink, and then there's kink. Why would anybody pay someone to crazy glue boots to their feet for a turn-on? Why would anyone pay someone to wrap their mouth and nose in saran wrap? And why on earth would anyone pay $11,000 to be treated that way? Police in San Diego are asking those questions too. Oh, and one more. Did the dominatrix intend to kill her client? That story is next.
You're listening to Banfield on News Nation's audio stream. Available 24/7 on the News Nation app, or just say, Alexa, play News Nation.
Admit it, we all do dumb things when we're drunk, but I will wager nothing dumber than what I'm about to tell you, and nothing more deadly. 56-year-old Michael Dale reportedly had a blood alcohol level of more than four times the legal limit when he decided to get kinky with an adult escort. Michaela Ray Larsden showed up at his door, and after some haggling, they agreed that Michaela would be paid $11,000 to fulfill Michael's every fantasy, which, according to the police, involved gorilla gluing a pair of women's boots to Michael's feet and wrapping his head up tightly in saran wrap. According to an affidavit, Michaela took video of the encounter for her OnlyFans page, video that showed Michael Dale lying on the ground, his head covered in saran wrap and duct tape and a plastic bag, and that video lasted 8 minutes. When Michael became unresponsive, Michaela eventually called 911, and when the cops arrived, they found her performing CPR. but it was a little too, or was it was too little, too late, because Michael Dale died a few days later in the hospital. 2 years after that, Michaela has now been charged with murder. For her part, she insisted that she'd never done this kind of fetish work before and that she's just a mother of three who simply ran a live adult entertainment service with her husband. Joining me now is Clara Harder, breaking news reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Clara, thanks so much for joining me. Did I get any of that wrong, just as the setup? Was all of that pretty much on point?
Oh, yeah, you got that completely correct in all the jarring, horrifying details.
I mean, it is a bit shocking. Michael Dale had some pretty surprising requests. I kind of had to reread it twice to make sure it was really what... But what, walk me through what really happened after they agreed to the $11,000 and then began to engage.
Yeah, so there was about 4 hours of fetish act performance that went on before she dialed 911. So she arrived at about 6 p.m. She told the police that he appeared pretty drunk when she arrived, but nonetheless, she continued to fulfill these wild fantasies, as you mentioned, gorilla gluing a pair of women's boots onto his feet. Another one was wrapping him, quote, like a mummy in saran wrap. And then escalating to this point where she put duct tape over his mouth and a plastic bag over his head and suffocated him for 8 minutes. And what this case really hinges on is that final terrifying act. And, you know, per the text messages where they were discussing what he wanted her to do, you know, this was never something that was mentioned.
Ah, okay, well, that makes a little more sense if it wasn't part of the written plan. But what sparked the 911 call ultimately?
He became unresponsive, so he passed out. So she dialed 911, and as you mentioned, she was performing CPR. But equally, she was filming herself for OnlyFans while he was unconscious, and those videos they found on her phone were taken just minutes before she dialed 911.
Do we have any idea what her defense is at this point? Because if she's on video paying no attention to someone who's on the floor for 8 minutes, I mean, we all know what a plastic bag around your mouth will do after 8 minutes. It will kill you. Like, the level of recklessness just sounds unimaginable. What is she saying?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't heard her words directly, but what I believe her attorneys may try to argue in court is for a charge of involuntary manslaughter, meaning that there was not intent to kill here, and that while he died, you know, there wasn't implied malice, and they'll probably, you know, lean heavily on the fact that he was requesting these various extreme fetish acts. I mean, prosecutors are not going to be wanting to hear that. They are arguing for second degree murder charges, which means that she didn't necessarily plan this murder far in advance. It wasn't long premeditated, but that there was nonetheless deliberate intent to cause harm. And there's no way she couldn't have known what she was doing, which, you know, as you mentioned, if you put a plastic bag around somebody's head for 8 minutes, pretty clear something's going to go wrong.
Yeah, I mean, that's the first thing we learn as kids, right? And it says it on the bags. Do not allow these things around children. So was the specific cause of death asphyxiation? Because I feel as though, look, I get it, Clara, this is a very kinky story, and I could see how it could become a media circus. But they seem to have cloaked a lot of these details behind, I'm not sure if it's gag orders, but we don't seem to be able to get access to a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I found it really hard to get this information. I tried to public records request the police department to get their report on the incident. And in the end, we had to send someone physically to the San Diego court to pull and copy the files. And in the files, we saw that they had ordered all the video evidence sealed from the public. So we can't look at any of those videos ourselves. But I would really want to. But most of the information that's been reported on this is based on a 2-page police affidavit that they filed when they were asking to arrest her. And in that affidavit, they note that the medical examiner's office concluded the cause of death was complications of anoxic ischemic encephalopathy due to resuscitated cardiopulmonary arrest due to asphyxia. Which is a very complicated way of saying that he suffocated to death and he died from lack of oxygen to the brain.
Yeah, and I think that video, regardless of whether you or I want to watch it, that jury, if there is going to be one, is going to have to watch it because it probably speaks volumes about what was going on in those moments. Clara Harder, it's great to have you on. Thanks so much for doing this. Come back again. Clara Harder joining us tonight from the Los Angeles Times. Okay, so coming up, they are the epitome of the American dream. A beautiful couple on vacation in Hawaii, snapping selfies worthy of a Christmas card. But there was something lurking beneath the surface of those wholesome shots. Something that ended with one of them being thrown from a Hawaiian cliff. That story's next.
News for All Americans is really just that. It's every voice being heard equally. Mr. President, my name is Kelly Meyer. I'm a White House correspondent for News Nation.
What do you say to Americans who want safe streets but are concerned due process is being violated?
Being front and center at the White House gives us that unique opportunity to talk to these officials and bring them the questions that matter most to all Americans. News Nation, news for all Americans.
Picture perfect couple, although I am willing to bet they might disagree. A 46-year-old anesthesiologist and his 36-year-old wife looked like they were living their best lives in Hawaii. Gerhard Koenig was working for a healthcare company in Hawaii, and his wife Arielle was working as a nuclear engineer. Publicly, his Facebook shows the couple's 2018 wedding photos and a pretty cute selfie of them together in front of the ocean. They reportedly share a $1.5 million home in Hawaii and by all accounts appear to have harnessed the American dream. But behind those selfies, some kind of trouble was brewing. And I say that because Gerhard has just been arrested and accused of tossing his wife over a scenic lookout and bashing her head in with a rock. Somehow she survived this, and she was taken to emergency in critical condition. Gerhard, though, took off, and he was on the run for the better part of a day before the police caught him. Here's what I could tell you about all of this so far. The couple had taken a quick trip from the island of Maui to the island of Oahu, where they decided to take in the sights of a popular hiking trail called the Pali Lookout. That is where police say Gerhard punched Arielle repeatedly, hit her in the head with a rock, and then pushed her off the famous lookout. She suffered serious head and facial injuries, but again, somehow she survived. Two witnesses to the attack called 911, and reports say the initial investigation shows that Arielle may have refused to take a selfie with her husband right before the attack. By the time the police arrived, Gerhard was long gone and stayed gone for about 8 hours. But after a short foot chase near the Pali Highway, they caught him. And according to Honolulu PD, he is now in custody with charges pending. According to his employer, Maui Health, they issued the following statement. Let me read it for you. Maui Health is committed to patient safety and upholding the highest standards of care. We have been made aware of the allegations against Gerhard Koenig, MD. Dr. Koenig has been suspended from the medical staff pending investigation. And you better believe we will keep you posted on what happens next in this case. But coming up next in this show, you are about to see a police officer's day go from business as usual to DEFCON chainsaw.
Hey, drop it! Drop it! Drop it! Drop it! I got one taser point. Step it up.
The call no officer wants to get, a retirement home, a domestic dispute, and an angry man with a chainsaw. We've got the full body cam video coming up next.
For listening to News Nation on the go. I'm Elizabeth Vargas. We're here for you 24/7 on the News Nation app or on your Alexa. Just say play News Nation.
Time inside a senior living facility, you know that you can see a lot of stuff, but what you don't often see is a man with a chainsaw demanding to see his wife. But that's exactly what people saw at the River Glen facility in St. Charles, Illinois a few months ago. The 911 call came in, and when the police arrived, the description was spot on. man with a chainsaw. He was trying to start it, and he was making some demands.
Drop it on the ground. On the ground. Get back. Drop the chainsaw. One at taser point.
Oh my God.
Hey, drop it. Drop it. I got one at taser point. Step it up.
Where is she?
Step it up. Drop it!
I just want my wife, man. I just want
listen,
my...
man. I don't want to.
Hey! Taser board! Taser. Hey!
Fuck
him. Where are you? Woo! Hey, right here! He's right here!
Get him out!
Come here!
He's not in the other side.
Off
there. Oh, shit!
You could see residents of the retirement home peppered all throughout that confrontation. And we had the shooting from a different angle as well on another cop's body cam. Suddenly, the chainsaw intruder charges directly at the police officer, hitting him. Police had no choice but to shoot the man to neutralize the threat to everybody who was there. An autopsy would show that he was high on meth and other amphetamines when he stormed that retirement home. And as it turned out, the man did not have a wife, either working or living there. And to this day, they don't know why he picked that place to terrorize everyone with a chainsaw. But just a few days ago, every officer who responded to that fatal shooting was not only cleared of any wrongdoing, they were praised for doing everything by the book because they likely saved a lot of lives that day. Just a reminder for you about this program tomorrow night, Amanda Knox. My interview continues with a couple of things that she said about the prosecutor, a very curious habit that he has developed daily. Not only that, how Harry Potter and Monica Lewinsky saved Amanda Knox. I'm not kidding. It's an amazing story. Join us for that. Also, my podcast, Drop Dead Serious, is up now. Great conversation with Brian Enten about the Idaho document dump. Lots on there. Meantime, stick around. Cuomo's coming up next.